You're listening to the Bitcoin.com podcast. Our guests today are Evan and Manny from Ampleforth. This episode is brought to you by Ledger, the secure gateway to all crypto services. With Ledger, you have access to buying, swapping, staking, or even lending crypto from one single app. Plus, everything is secured. What you need is a Ledger hardware wallet, which combined with a Ledger app allows you to secure and truly own your crypto. All of this while giving you the freedom to easily manage your assets. There's no need to use different platforms to manage and secure your crypto. You have one place for all your crypto needs. Go to ledger.com. That's LEDGER.com and take full control over your crypto. I'm your host, Dustin Plantholt. Join us as we dive into the world of economics, politics, tech, Bitcoin, and cryptocurrency. For even more crypto-related news, sign up at news.bitcoin.com or follow us on Twitter at Bitcoin.com. Now let's bring on our guest. Evan and Manny, welcome to the Bitcoin.com podcast.
Thank you, Dustin. I'm really excited to be here.
Thanks. I'm really happy to be here as well. I've listened to quite a number of your episodes, actually.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. And today we're here to talk about Ampleforth and how you both got into cryptocurrency. And then in a bit, Manny, we're going to talk about why somebody from Harvard wants to get into the crypto space. But what I'm finding is that a number of these universities around the world, Harvard being one of them, is that they're starting to embrace the technology aspect. So let's dig in. Evan, you are the CEO of a company called Ampleforth. What is Ampleforth? And by the way, I'm all about names. How'd you come up with the name?
Yeah, I mean, just a quick clarification. I'm the CEO of a company called Fragments Inc., which produced a cryptocurrency called Ampleforth, which is now becoming just a public good to be owned by no one, just kind of like Bitcoin. And Ampleforth, it is a cryptocurrency, much like Bitcoin. It's rules-based. But the unique thing about it is it can be used to denominate stable contracts. And that's exciting to us because we see a lot of contracts being built on top of cryptocurrencies. And this is an enabling feature for developing an alternative financial ecosystem that is beyond the reach of politics. But to get to your quick question about the name, Ampleforth, Ampleforth is actually a character from Orwell's 1984. He was kind of this goofy guy. And I guess his job is to, you know, every day go through poems and other kind of literature and make sure it complies with Big Brother's requirements as far as use of language. He finally gets to this Rudyard Kipling poem and discovers that there's no suitable replacement for the word God in this poem that would actually make technical sense. He refuses to censor himself in that way. And well, it's kind of sad in the same way that everyone's ending is sad in that book. Like, you know, he kind of just gets persecuted as a result. And so in a way, it's a reminder of how we got to cryptocurrency to begin with as kind of a movement. And there was something about the sincere nature of his truth. It wasn't like he was he didn't feel better than other people. It's not like he had this huge ethos or moral authority behind his actions. He just simply saw the truth and refused to kind of conceal or modify it.
Interesting. And so from your side, Manny, what got you engaged or involved, or candidly, what attracted you to this project? I mean, yeah, and I'm going to brag for you. You're a Harvard guy. There's a lot of companies out there in this ecosystem that you could have been advising. Why Ampleforth?
Dustin, now you're sounding like my parents who feel the need to tell our extended family that I am, in fact, a Harvard graduate. So I originally got interested in cryptocurrency back in 2014 when I was actually doing my graduate work at Harvard back then. And I took a class with Christine Dasan. She's a very sort of prominent constitutional scholar at the law school. And I had taken one of her other courses, and she encouraged me to take her course on the constitutional nature of money. So how money is constituted through the legal system. And, at that point, there had been all these news about Mt. Gox and so on. So at one point, I brought up the question, like, could Bitcoin become money? Could there be money outside of the state? And I think she felt very strongly that the answer was no. I'm a bit rebellious, but I think I also have certain intuitions of my own. So there was always something in the back of my mind telling me that there was something missing that the Bitcoin experiment was sort of getting at. I think that was kind of not fully encompassed in how scholars, either in economics or in the law, were thinking about money. So that kind of stayed with me for a while. In 2017, a lot of projects came out of the woodwork kind of asking about, you know, what is money? And I felt lucky to be able to contribute something since I'd been thinking about it for 10 years at that point. And then in 2018, I think it was, I met Evan. So there was a dinner hosted by Sam Lessing, who's a VC, a former early Facebook guy. And so we were seated right next to each other. And we had a number of, I remember quite vividly, exchanges about, you know, monetary policy, how money is created, all these other things. And so he imprinted very heavily on me because he seemed, you know, to be very smart, but also a little bit stubborn. And so that was actually the beginning of our friendship and then later collaboration into, you know, what became Ampleforth.
Wow. So it sounds to me that he earned your respect and he earned your trust. So talking about that, Evan, I mean, what sort of hours does it take? Okay, so you're an entrepreneur. You got this crazy idea. It's sitting in your head. You want to get it out. You ultimately get it out. How many hours does it take to get here? I mean, what sort of commitment does an entrepreneur have to put in?
That's a really good question. And I think it's probably different for most entrepreneurs. So, I mean, in our case, the process of fundraising, you know, takes at least, you know, a few weeks. But really, the ideation, I think this might be a little bit unique to cryptocurrencies, but you really do want to measure like 10 times and cut once, because ideally these contracts are immutable and they're meant to be long-lived and have long-lived visions. Like, we wouldn't be terribly happy if Bitcoin was constantly changing every other day, right? And so, you know, measuring a bunch of times and cutting once is the name of the game in this particular, you know, version of entrepreneurship. And so we went through at least five different iterations of this protocol. And in parallel, there was this journey, which is the journey that kind of most closely involves Manny, which is this question of what is money? What is the fundamental opportunity that's created by blockchain technology and revealed by Bitcoin? And how can we improve upon that? And it turns out that wasn't so easy. So we probably went through four or five versions of this protocol. And we started out with something that more closely resembled a bank that happened to be on a distributed ledger, and finally ended up with something that really is a commodity money, except that it can be used for stable contracts. So we really started up with something closer to a dollar and wanted to get it as close as possible to what Bitcoin is today, with just this added feature of being able to be used in contract denomination.
Now,
that's not a hard answer for in terms.
No,
of hours,
but it's a great explanation of it. So that leads me to Manny on your side, that you can tell that Evan is truly brilliant. Like, he's on another level. That how hard was it, or maybe it was easy for you to hear his vision and say, I'll support you and I'll back you? That I imagine in the beginning it was the concept. I got a concept. I just now need to turn it from concept to execution.
So in the beginning, Evan, I think when he and I met, they were going through the iteration of the protocol that had a balance sheet. So that, you know, there was going to be algorithmic buying and selling of coupons or bonds. And to me, you know, history shows that's a system that's bound to break if you don't have a body of economic activity that both anchors that and then also pegs. With reserve funds just break in the end, you know, it's sort of a law of history. Evan at that point and his co-founder Brandon were sort of iterating on this. So I think, you know, Evan, correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys reached out, I think it must have been like 6 months later when you guys were on the next iteration of the protocol. And I think at that point it was easier because they had gotten rid of the balance sheet aspect of it. And so I think we felt much more aligned, and I felt very much excited by that version of the protocol, which was called Microfragments. I think that was the iteration that you shared with me. So it was, you know, in some ways, I think it was both hard and easy. In some ways, it was hard because they were at a certain point, I think, in this intellectual journey. And it was easy because they were eventually going to get to the right answer because they had already been willing to make changes, unlike a lot of other teams and projects which really dig down on their initial concept and design, and they're not willing to really evolve it. So, you know, my slogan is that crypto is like financial history in a petri dish. So, you know, if you're just willing to do a little bit of the work and do a little bit of the reading, you can sort of see ahead and be kind of ahead of everybody else in the petri dish. And they really sort of went through that process.
Now, you know, Evan, because of your track record and you have been involved and been an entrepreneur and CEO for some time, is it very common that once you come up with the idea, the business, that you might navigate in another direction, or you might change the direction of which you thought it was going to go?
It is very common. I think more often than not in traditional startup businesses, you'll throw something out there and you'll start gathering data, and for whatever reason, it won't perfectly work. And at that point, you're confronted with, you know, the opportunity to pivot, to either usually zoom in and take one feature of a product that you were kind of presenting and say, let's make that feature the entire product, or zoom out and say, well, we have this thing and it's kind of desirable, but it really needs to belong to a suite of products. And, you know, largely what we did with in moving from Fragments to Ampleforth is we zoomed in. We had this kind of currency that was proportionally increasing and decreasing in supply based on demand. And we had it connected with a reserve that would automatically act as a buyer of coupons to stabilize it. And we realized that that could never actually function robustly enough to check against a traditional bank. And so we dropped the reserve and we asked, well, what's left? And it turns out it's this commodity money that has a natural supply elasticity to it, such that it can be used in contracts. And I distinctly remember with Manny, we had a tough conversation after that dinner, because I think that he liked what I had to say. He wanted to learn, sent him a paper. He brought me to a bar and he was like, I don't know if I like this balance sheet, man. He gave me some very kind of frank feedback. And I was just like, what does this guy know anyways? He's a historian. These Harvard people, they always like sound like they know more than they do.
Yeah, he's we're a the diva, engineers. This guy.
We're going to figure it all out anyways. So I went home and Brandon and we just thought through it. Every single possible case, concluded that, you know, the reserve itself wouldn't work, dropped it. And then, you know, I kind of forgot about Manny for a while because, you know, we were just excited with this new direction. And then I sent an email to Manny, attached a paper. And from that point on, he was certainly a lot more excited. He was like, hey, man, you should come to my birthday party. We got things to talk about. You know, let's hang out.
He was your BFF from there on. That's how it began.
We dropped the balance sheet. We dropped the reserve. And suddenly it was like, wow, Manny really wants to hang out. He wants to introduce me to Neil. He wants to collaborate. It's like, what gives?
So it sounds, Manny, that to me that Evan was open to guidance and accountability and direction. That is that what it takes? That when you're an advisor to a startup, that the CEO must be open to the things that he or she maybe haven't thought of from a different perspective or see it from a different lens?
I think that's right. It's no one likes to be giving advice or, you know, saying things into the void and then having them be lost. And I think oftentimes some CEOs are of that sort, where I think they're a little bit headstrong. On the other hand, I mean, I think what I really liked about Evan was that he was sort of getting, you know, he was getting advice and feedback from everywhere and synthesizing it in quite a nice way. So throughout that process, I was also learning quite a bit. I think I've learned, you know, one of the joys of being an advisor is you learn a lot. I mean, I think at this point, I know so much more about crypto than I thought could ever even be possibly learned. And so, you know, this came out of this collaboration.
And now let's talk about hiring, the hiring process for you, Evan. I mean, we live in a digital world. You're a super smart guy. I admire and respect everything that you've done. How do you find that next ambassador to join your team, knowing ultimately that they are a reflection on you and a reflection then on Manny and any of the other advisors and teammates that you have?
I mean, it's tough. I think in general with engineering, because Brandon, our third co-founder here, is he's such a great and experienced interviewer, having worked at Google in the search department and at Uber. I think he's given maybe close to 1,000 technical interviews. And so with engineering hires, we can just put them through the ringer. I remember even our first hire when it was just me and Brandon in a room, you know, we went through like 30 or 40 of these interviews and put him through the Google search interview, and Nitin kind of passed with flying colors. And so we were 100% confident that he was going to be able to hit the ground and deliver. With other hires where the role is not as specific, it's a lot harder because you do need to kind of attempt to gauge their ability to do this job, which might be very, very uncertain. So, I mean, say if you're hiring somebody to do BD, it's not exactly like we're doing enterprise sales and there's this list of crypto buyers out there. We're going to go down the list and call them. It's more like creating a set of values, like writing the Bible, so to speak, and then kind of figuring out ways to disseminate the set of values out to kind of the broader world. And you have to get creative with it. And so a little bit of it is about taking our time. So in the case of Richie and with Manny, we got so comfortable working with one another for months before it became more of a full-time arrangement. And yeah, I would say there's a different process for different roles.
That's great counsel. So as the CEO, you never get to turn it off, that you never get to say I'm off duty, that no matter the time of day, you're always expected. So how do you find the balance to not burn out? And then I'm also going to ask you the same thing, Mr. Harvard, of giving some advice to CEOs out there to how to not burn out, specifically within the crypto space.
I mean, I think in general, we are kind of turning the corner a little bit, but in the beginning, you feel you are fully accountable for it. So if things mess up, there's no one to blame other than me. And, you know, and felt as though my labor efforts were extremely important to kind of just keeping the roof up. But, you know, the key is kind of surrounding yourself with good people, whether you're growing a traditional corporation or in our case, something different with crypto and Ampleforth in particular. I am the CEO, again, of this company that produced the currency. But the currency is actually owned by a nonprofit and issued by a nonprofit called the Ampleforth Foundation, of which I'm not really, you know, a director of. And we are trying to make this transition where no one, including Manny or me or Brandon, is an essential actor in the functionality of the cryptocurrency and the ongoing kind of maintenance of it. And so we really do have to think about how to pay it forward and cultivate a community that will then kind of take on this responsibility. And it is very stressful because it's a 24-hour nonstop global market. But I found that it is essential and imperative to be able to sleep at night, right? It's almost as though people think it's like if you're the CEO, you kind of have to lose sleep at night over all these kind of crazy issues. But I actually think like if you are the CEO, it's almost your job not to let these various kind of life-threatening issues cause you to lose sleep. And so just kind of have to have that level of risk tolerance built into your personality or become habituated to it or something. And really it's just about surrounding yourself with lieutenants whom you can give more and more of this responsibility to. That's pretty much how I've gone about it.
That's a great perspective. And Manny, what have you seen? And I will tell you that, and I read a quote recently that said, being a CEO used to be something you did for 15 years. Now you do it for 5, maybe. The lifespan is getting shorter and shorter, regardless if you're a man or a woman. Why is that?
I think at least in our space, right, in crypto, a lot of it is because of this petri dish kind of speed of evolution, I think, of all the products and all the infrastructure, where organizations, I think, used to be much more longer lived just because the mission and kind of their niche needed to be played out and took, you know, more people and more resources. And the change in the physical world took some time for that to take hold. I think in crypto, especially in things like DeFi, a protocol might be useful really for maybe a year or two, and then it's just going to be superseded by something else. So I think people are much more comfortable now with forming teams quickly, getting something out, and then gracefully stepping down rather than trying to kind of, you know, use one success to then pivot into the next one. I think there's an idea that the protocol lives in the community, right? It lives on the network, and it's your baby, right? You don't own your children. They kind of lead their own lives, and then you move on to the next thing. So I think it's getting more comfortable with that. And I was going to say a little bit about what Evan was saying earlier. I think there's a culture in the Valley, and I think VCs push it a lot, that you know, CEOs or founders must be kind of working themselves to the bone. But from what I've seen, usually there's very key decisions that teams make and companies make, which are kind of more important than anything else that they do that year. I think for Ampleforth, I think the Geyser program was kind of a big thing last year. And in contrast, you know, there were all these other meetings where people were worried about little things. Looking back on it, it's like none of those things really made a difference in the end, right? It was really this, you know, one key decision. And I think being able to focus on that requires that you be very mentally sharp and not be burning out.
And Evan, from a community standpoint, you know, what have you learned about your community and what's it been like to build it?
Well, it's that it kind of takes a life of its own. So in the beginning, you know, you can only do so much to kind of create a community from thin air. Again, we wrote all this material, and in many ways, the Ampleforth protocol is the encoding of a set of values into something that might live beyond us, right? A currency. And we put the materials out there. And what happened was we created this Geyser program that led us to kind of go through orders of magnitude of growth. I think in a 40-day period or so, we grew from a $20 million fully diluted market cap to a $1.65 billion fully diluted market cap.
Wow. I mean, look, and I don't mean to cut you off, but that's remarkable. A $1.6 billion market cap.
That's right. And that was on the backs of a Telegram community that had kind of, I guess, intersected with a 4chan community. And they had taken the materials that we had written and made it, I guess, sensationally fun. It became a little bit of a cultural phenomenon on a daily basis. We had this supply chain that automatically executes, and there would be people hanging around the hoop, creating memes and celebrating this. And, you know, it was really terrifying for me because it's like, wow, I don't think everybody who's involved in this fully understands the intent of what we did, right? But they understand a little bit, and now they're telling all their friends about it. And it's just evolving so quickly that it is not something that's entirely within our control. And so what we can be at best is a source, a grounding point of truth. To some extent, we kind of fork the community and create this like Discord channel that's a little bit more managed and allowed the Telegram channel to kind of live on in its wild, natural way. And we are just one of many voices now kind of explaining what Ample is. But I think being present and trying to answer questions is extremely important, and creating experiences that people can kind of have together digitally is really important as well.
And Manny, from your perspective, I mean, to be involved with an organization and be involved with an entrepreneur, a brilliant CEO like Evan, to be able to see this thing take off must just be so rewarding.
It was very rewarding, and then it was also very stressful. because at that point I started wondering, wait a second, I own some of this. Where is my hardware wallet? So, and I think the volatility, in the market cap during those days was so strong that I think I actually did lose sleep. So I, you know, my full-time job is as a researcher, in history at Stanford at the Hoover Institution. And I'm obliged to tell you that all opinions expressed herein are not the decision of the Hoover Institution or Stanford University. So I do have this, you know, day job, and it was just the news about Ampleforth coming in. I was just like, oh man, this is really starting to get to me. But it was terribly exciting. And I think it was clear that rebasing was doing, you know, was kind of this new innovation in this space, and that it was, I'm still waiting for a whole slew of other rebasing products to really take that and really apply to new problem spaces. I think a lot of what we saw in that summer was a lot of clones that really wanted to latch onto the momentum of Ampleforth. But I think the rebasing has this thing where it short circuits people's reasoning, and I don't think they quite understand what it actually does. So we're still sort of waiting for that. And I think Ampleforth, as kind of the first mover, has a very nice lead.
And Evan, from your side, I mean, that must be the greatest form of flattery in its own way when others are trying to replicate what you and your team have done.
It is, and it's also awful because, so it's imitation is flattery, I agree with that, but often they're imitating us and saying, you know what, you know how the Ampleforth team messed this thing up? Well, we did everything they did except we changed that.
Oh gosh, they throw you under a bus is what you're saying.
That's right, in a very aggressive way, and these are very organized digital communities, sometimes they're anonymous, and it's happened so many times. And so it convolutes the messaging because everybody's top line is, well, you know how the Ampleforth team, you know, raised VC money? We did the same thing they did, and we didn't need any VC money. That's what's wrong with them, right? And so whatever quality we have, they could kind of attack in a passively narrative way. They would, and they would fork and clone. But largely, these clones have fizzled out. And what remains a little bit is some of the misinformation that they've put out there along the way. But I think over time, that will erode as well. And the other terrifying thing about growing really quickly is like folks who don't understand you kind of want to just overtly attack you. And that has certainly happened to me as well.
Well, I'm going to tell you right now, and I am talking to all of the trolls out there that have attacked the project and attacked Evan. He is under my protection now. I'm just letting you know. It is on like Donkey Kong. Keep going.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I appreciate the opportunity here to kind of explain what we've been working on. But it really does come down to, you know, being able to succinctly explain what the Ample is. And it is kind of just it's like Bitcoin, except it can be used in contracts. Like if you and I were to enter in a simple bet and we were, let's say, going to shake our hands and say, like, look, if the Lakers make it to the 2021 NBA Finals, you're going to pay me 10 coins. Otherwise, I'll pay you 10 coins. We wouldn't want to do that bet in Bitcoin, because we're not sure what the price of Bitcoin will be at that time. And I might end up owing you a great deal more money than I thought, which leads to a high likelihood of default. But the things that we love about Bitcoin is its censorship resistance. It doesn't rely on traditional banks. It doesn't rely on bailouts. It's non-dilutive and therefore a good store of value. And so we tried to capture all of those qualities with Amples, and I think largely we have. It is completely non-dilutive. All the supply increases and decreases are automatic and proportional, except it can be used in contracts because the price is relatively stable, and it's really just the number of units in your wallet that increases or decreases based on demand rather than the price per unit. And so, yeah, that's kind of the directionality of Ampleforth. And I think what Manny means when he talks about we're waiting for this next generation of excitement, I think we're waiting for the generation of protocols and contracts that use this new money to come into existence. It's almost like these cryptocurrencies are a new generation of digital precious metals, Ample being one of them, Bitcoin being one of them. And DeFi is a new generation of basic banks designed to like trade, exchange, lend, and borrow these new precious metals. And there's a lot of excitement around these new basic banks that use these precious metals as well.
So give it to me, and I always say, like, dumb it down for Dustin. What does the token do?
The token translates the volatility of price into the volatility of quantity. So you've got a wallet with Amples in it, and when the price of Ample trades at greater than $1, the number of tokens in your wallet automatically increases. And when the price of the Ample trades at less than $1, the number of tokens in your wallet automatically decreases. And these changes, they happen universally and proportionally. So everybody's quantity increases or everybody's quantity decreases. What this does effectively is it translates the volatility of demand from price to count. And in a way that simply can't be broken, just like Bitcoin can't break. We're not like, you know, we're not maintaining a hard peg. There is no reserve. There are no banks. There's nothing there except for the currency itself. It's a commodity money, but it so happens that then you and I can go ahead and enter that bet and say, like, if the Lakers make it to the 2021 semifinals, I'll pay you 1,000 Ample. Otherwise you pay me 1,000 Ample. We can enter that bet and not wonder, well, will I accidentally be on the hook for, you know, the down payment of a house rather than, you know, a serious bet. And that's the basis of this new ecosystem that is being created on top of rebasing currencies like Ample.
Now, Manny, from your perspective, I mean, having the education, Harvard, I'm going to rub it in again. I have a community college background. How different is this cryptocurrency or digital assets from traditional currency? I mean, what I have read, and again, I only know what I've read, is that anytime a government needs money, they just turn on a printing press. Like, is that so bad?
Well, some people would say it's quite good, and I think her new Treasury Secretary would like to protect the state monopoly on money. I think what history shows is that very rarely do monies perform, you know, the three functions that economists give them, right? I actually like to think of a different set of, you know, functions that money performs. One is, you know, allowing supply to adapt to demand. The other one's, you know, maintaining a peg. And the other one is durable value. And for a lot of history, monies tend to just perform two of these functions, and they perform them quite well. And they don't try to do everything. Fiat money, which kind of performs all three, and that you can, you know, you can print out to keep prices stable, is actually a very recent innovation, you know, following the Second World War. What Evan is referring to, I think what Ampleforth is really good for is for the nominating contracts. And in some ways, that's the most ancient feature of money, which the state monopolized. And it was the first thing that the state monopolized. And it's where a lot of theories, you know, like chartalism sort of came from, where modern monetary theory is kind of grounded. It's the ability of the state to decide what counts as legal tender. So circulating media of exchange might be something else, but if taxes and legal contracts have to be settled in something called the dollar, I mean, that is the power of the denomination, and that's what anchors the dollar as a currency in the system. What Ampleforth really reminds me of is kind of the role of silver in the Chinese monetary system, where the actual circulating money was copper and it was not pegged to silver. But the imperial state wanted tax payments in a particular weight of silver. And so, you know, it was kind of this, you know, denominating currency that was, in fact, not necessarily the currency of most of commerce, right? Because it was just so costly to transport and do all these other things with it. So, you know, I see echoes of the past. I think it's just a lot of what's important about contract denomination is kind of missed, just because, you know, I think for a few generations, we haven't had to think about that, right? It's fiat money. That's how you denominate things. And you don't actually get to decide denomination. So, yeah.
I guess I could expand on that really quickly, which is, I think that to your point, like money printing, it's arguably good, arguably bad. I think the ability of a central bank's to print money countercyclically to stimulate us out of a jam, like they're doing right now, is a very kind of powerful function, right, of a central bank. And it fits within the central bank's mandate, maintain, you know, moderate long-term interest rates, like kind of see to employment working out well and kind of keeping price inflation in check. Those are kind of the mandates of the Federal Reserve. And I think they do that well. I think the function of kind of government independent monies like Bitcoin and Ample is to act as a check against these traditional banks, perhaps not replace them entirely, but, you know, just to provide an alternative so that, you know, things don't get too carried away. And it turns out the two things that tend to get carried away are, for central banks in general, is inflation. There's always a possibility that we could see price inflation as a result of money printing. And the other thing is the perpetuation of boom and bust cycles. So some might say that if you're stimulating your way out of a jam today, you're just kind of kicking the can down the road for tomorrow and setting yourself up for a major correction, which could result in dislocations in the labor market, kind of just a refactoring of the economy and setbacks. So economists kind of disagree about how to handle those situations. But the fact that an alternative exists kind of is great, because now we can buy things like Bitcoin just in case we're worried about price inflation. We buy Ample in case we're worried about price inflation. Or if we don't like being trapped in kind of a long recession cycle, then we can purchase an asset that's slightly more disconnected from traditional indicators of consumption and production. And so as we think about creating this alternative financial ecosystem, in order for it to increasingly become powerful as a check against the traditional system, it needs to kind of adequately take on alternate functions of the traditional system, if not in a better way, just in a reasonably suitable way. And the ability to create contracts like lending and borrowing on top of an asset and on top of a unit of account is fundamental to that. And more importantly, like Manny was saying, this kind of primary feature of denomination in a currency, it gives rise to a stickiness that is the quality that allows these central banks to kind of print a bunch of money and not immediately have to pay for the consequences of it. And so it is it is something to keep in check as well.
So how do we learn more about Ampleforth?
I would encourage you to visit our website, which is ampleforth.org. And if you have questions, I would encourage anybody here to join our Discord group and ask them.
Evan and Manny, thank you again for sharing your story on the Bitcoin.com podcast.
Thank you, Dustin.
Thank you, Dustin.
You've listened to another episode of the Bitcoin.com podcast. Subscribe at news.bitcoin.com, where your journey begins.